Dear Asian Girl, for Asian girls, by Asian girls.
Welcome to Dear Asian Girl, everyone. My name is Mena, for those who are new listeners. I go by she, her pronouns. I am Punjabi Indian. And yeah, welcome to the podcast if you're new. This is Isabel joining with me today as our new co-host. This is her first episode recording. So Isabel, would you like to introduce yourselves to our listeners?
Yeah. Hi, everyone. My name is Isabel Young. I use she, they pronouns. I currently live in Boston, Massachusetts, and I'm a 17-year-old, soon-to-be senior in high school. I am Burmese and Vietnamese American, and I'm super excited to be here today.
And we're also joined by our guest, Leela, who is the co-leader of the Dear Asian Youth Book Club. Leela, would you just like to start us off with how they came to fruition and what the book club is about?
Hi guys, I'm Leela. The book club is all about bringing together people to read more Asian literature. I've joined some other book clubs like around my school and my community, and none of them focus on amazing Asian authors that I've read and I've suggested things. So I think what we want to do is create a safe environment for everyone to express their love and their thoughts on books that they read that diversify their library.
Yeah, thank you. And I actually haven't been in a book club in my life or my school life. Isabel, have you had any experience with book clubs?
Yeah, I've been part of a couple of like my school book chats, and similar to Leela, like I found that they never really center around like Asian authors or like Asian literature. And I think one of my first classes where I read a book by an Asian author, I was really shocked at how I could relate to it so much. And that just shows how, you know, like the Dear Asian Youth Book Club is so important for Asian youth, but also like youth in general.
Yeah, because I feel like a lot of what barred me almost from really getting to literature initially was like that feeling of like you're never really gonna relate to these things, so just don't bother going headfirst expecting to like get these big rewards, until I went to Asian literature, and definitely has so many benefits. And specifically the books that we're going to be talking about today, which is Crying H Mart, which I'm sure many of our listeners have heard about, probably read about, probably cried over, maybe some of us including. It's a book, for those of you who don't know, it's a memoir written by Michelle Zahner, who is the lead singer of Japanese Breakfast, an indie band. And Crying H Mart is just basically like an ode to her mother, who she was grieving over. She had a long battle with cancer, and she explores her relationship with her mother through food, since that was a very big connection that she had to her through Korean food. So throughout the book, you can expect a lot of very vivid imagery of different Korean dishes, a lot of very specific references to her culture and ties with her family, and other themes that come with being an Asian American, potentially growing up with language barriers, since she didn't know Korean that well when she was a child and had some difficulties getting closer to her other family, and a lot of other nuances that I can't cover in a short blurb. But Leela, you just told us you're at the book club and some stuff about the book club. So what led the book club to choose this book?
So we wanted it to be a fairly democratic process. So on the initial interest form that we sent out for the book club when we first announced it back in December last year, me and the other three co-leads researched different Asian authors from different parts of the world, from Thailand to China to Asian American authors. And we wrote up short synopsis for each of them. And we had, when they filled out the interest form, the members voted on them. And Crying H Mart had like the most votes of any book, and like we gave them an option to pick multiple books from the list, but it was an astounding difference between the other books. And we are getting to the other books that were on the list, but Crying in H Mart was like so popular.
Yeah, and I think a huge factor of that is the fact that it's tied to an artist that many of us know and love, and that brings many people to think about the popularity that Crying H Mart has gotten in the mainstream with the general population, not just among Asian youth. And why do you think in general this book has gotten such popularity with the people in your book club, or as well with other people in the world that are reading it? What's the allure?
I think part of it is, if you are Asian American, you can be like, oh, H Mart, I've been there, or I have people who've been to H Mart, and it rings a bell. So I think it brings people in because it's familiar. And not saying that other memoirs can't be familiar, but when it's by an Asian American author and when the reader is an Asian American person, it can spring some nostalgia.
Yeah, I remember I actually filled out the form for the Dear Asian Youth Book Club, and I remember seeing Crying in H Mart, and I was like, I have no clue what this book could be about, but I see H Mart and I can relate to that. And that's one of the biggest reasons why, when I got the book for my birthday, and the reason why it's on my Goodreads list at all, is because I found that relatability and I was like, yes, this is the book that could change my perspective or introduce something that I can relate to that I haven't seen in other books that I've read before.
Yeah, I actually never had that much proximity, like emotional or also distance wise, because living in Los Angeles, everything is just wide open spaces and a drive that's pretty lengthy sometimes. But I was never that emotionally connected with any stores or any like grocery stores that were Asian. And if you were asking me to like list a, or like even state an Indian food store name, I cannot give you one off the top of my head. So reading a book that was about like such an emotional connection to a grocery store, that was definitely like a new perspective, like you were saying. And it's also potentially a new perspective to like non-POC communities or other POC communities that maybe don't have that tie to food in that way. We also like have to think about Asian literature has definitely not been in the mainstream. It's definitely not been accepted that easily by like white communities, for example. Like I've definitely seen in the past very like crude reactions to like even like Asian food in general. Like we've talked about this on the podcast, how like bringing your Asian food to lunch can be a very mortifying experience sometimes, because people that aren't used to Asian food may be very, they'll try to ridicule it because they're just not used to that culture. So there's also been some ideas that because of like the spot that the Asian communities have gotten because of hate crimes that have happened, some people believe that it's gained popularity because of that. And we'd like to talk about why that's very hurtful to assume that, and that there's no actual substance to the book, and that the book itself doesn't have any good aspects to it.
I feel like a lot of people try to find reasons to justify things happening. When things are going good for our community, people try to find reasons to be like, oh, well, they're just getting this attention because this happened. Why can't we just accept that something is changing for the better? You know, I never had to deal with bringing Asian food to school because I'm adopted. But I did see some of my friends, some of my Indian friends who would bring food, they would get like such horrible reactions from other kids around them. They like, what are you eating? I'm like, Jesus, this is your food. But when people want to start breaking into the mainstream, quote unquote, it's a good thing. It's natural progress. So saying it, oh, it's only happening because people feel sorry and people like want to learn more. Like people don't feel sorry. I feel like people should just want to learn more, find a different perspective, like we were saying.
Yeah, and your point makes me think of the book The Woman Warrior by Maxine Hong Kingston. And she published it in, I think, 1976. And I remember like reading her book and then eventually reading reviews of her book at the time. And a lot of people were saying, like, even though her book is a memoir, people were saying, oh, this is either too exotic or too Chinese. Or people were saying it wasn't Chinese enough because it was like her raw experience as an Asian American. And I think the point of Crying in H Mart isn't to focus. I mean, it is to focus on the fact that she grew up Korean American, but also like it wasn't to center just around the fact that she was, quote unquote, struggling in her life in America. She also had so many joys and so much happiness.
Yeah, and I feel like people try to push the victim complexes onto minorities so much Because in my opinion, the way that I see it, it's like pity is just another word for like condescension at this point. It's just trying to belittle communities so like the only experiences that they can share are full of like sob stories of like intergenerational trauma and all this like pain that has come from like racism and like all these systemic issues. But there are stories of like celebrations that can be told. There are stories of great love and great emotion that can be told. And it's really harmful, like you're saying, the people that were commenting specifically like not Asian enough. It's clear that when they opened this book, they were looking for like every Asian stereotype you can look at. It doesn't encapsulate the full experience. So now I think we should finally start talking about the actual book. And obviously the most prevalent part of it is the food and the culture that is being referenced. And like we were talking about, there's a lot of difficulty having that be deemed as normal by mainstream society in quotation marks. So we want to talk about how do these details of food and culture attempt to normalize the Asian culture?
It's just really great to see someone talk about their food in such a loving way, because I'm Chinese, but seeing her just proudly talk about how she can connect with her mother through the food that her mother created and made for her is very touching. And I think it's also makes it better for other audiences who are not Asian to see that this food that we've constantly been teased for and made fun of, and that this food means more than just something to fill our stomachs. It connects us to our parents. And I just read Pachinko on my own, and there's a scene in the book where some older Korean grandmothers are very surprised that a younger generation doesn't know how to cook their food and doesn't know how to eat it properly, like what to eat it with. And I think food is a very integral part of many cultures, not just Asian cultures, because it connects us to our history and our past. And I think the way Michelle Zahner connects it to her grief in her healing process is very important.
Yeah, and there's so much love and so much nuance that goes into every dish. Like the one quote, I have no clue which book it's from. I don't know if it's just a quote that was randomly stated on TikTok, but the quote where it's like, your face is proof that generations of every family have been loved. Yeah, your existence is proof that generations of your family have been loved. And I think the same can be related to food. The fact that this dish is so important to your family proves that like there are so many generations behind this dish that have like put their own nuances into like how to cook it, on how it's served, and the meanings of it, and like traditions, because Asian food is also centered around a lot of Asian traditions and holidays and celebrations. So there's definitely more significance. And I also think another thing that is very important about the specificity of the details of the food in the book is like, usually the way that people would perceive Asians, it's like, it's vague, to say the least. It's vague. Like to most of American society, it's just China, Korea, and Japan. And if you ask them like name East Asian countries, they know the East Asian countries. They don't know that geographically. Like I've talked to people who don't even know that India is part of the Asian continent. So it's bad. Geography is like bad out here. Like you have an atlas in your background. It's not that hard to like study geography and know that. But people just assume Asians are very homogenous. And I think the details like really show the specific nuances that you can see with Korean food, which would definitely be different with like Chinese food that you would be more aware of, because you wouldn't know any Korean dishes because there's so many differences to it.
Yeah, and I think like the connection that I've made with like my family members, even though I haven't been to Myanmar, Burma, and Vietnam in so long, eating the food from there is like for my grandmothers, like it just connects me so much to where I'm from or where my parents were from. That connection really solidifies who I am as a person. Sometimes I don't feel like I am part of America because I do have this side of me that, you know, is Burmese and Vietnamese, and I want to be able to connect with that side too, because that's so much of how I was raised and what my parents are.
Yeah, and especially when we see her go back to Seoul in Korea, and like I stated earlier, she struggles with like language barriers. So there are many scenes in the book where she's feeling insecure about how much she's contributing to her mom's health, making sure her mom is comfortable when, like, there's so many other relatives sort of flocking around her, seemingly holding up with the stress better than she is, seemingly helping her mother more than she can. And she decides to channel all this energy into cooking really good food for her mom that will make her feel comfortable, that will make her feel, you know, still some of the love and the positive associations you have from cultural food. And I think it's just really poetic the way that, like, Michelle Zahner writes how, like, these food connections, like, transcend all these linguistic boundaries. And it's basically like you were saying, like, going back to Vietnam for you is, like, very positive for you in that way, and, like, food connections are a very central part of that. And then another part of the book that I personally really enjoyed and personally, like, really resonated with was the save 10% of yourself quote. And usually I feel like this is one of the biggest quotes that people that read Crime and H-Mart get away with and really, yeah, just really hold close to them. So what are your thoughts on this piece of advice, and what are your takes on it?
I really like this advice. I don't think I really ever thought of the way her mom put it, because when you're doing schoolwork, when you're in a relationship, whether with friends or a significant other, you think that you're putting your all into it. And that's always a good thing, because you want to go 110%. And sometimes that just doesn't work. If something happens that doesn't go as planned, if something happens to that friendship, if something happens to that relationship, then you need to have something saved for yourself. And I think that I've made the mistake of putting my all into friendships. When things don't go well, then I'm very devastated by them. And I think this is advice that everyone can take from, because a lot of people that I know push really hard to do everything. And it's just, it doesn't work that way. You just have to, you have to make sure that you're taking time for yourself. It's self-care, essentially. If you're putting all of your energy into someone else or something else, then what's going to happen when that's over? Then you're just left with nothing. And I think what her mom said is something everyone should listen to.
Well, for me, when I read the quote, I thought about it a lot, because I, like you said, Layla, like, you know, think that giving my all is a good thing. And I think, you know, saving part of myself almost seems like I'm hiding part of myself. And I think over time, as I thought about the quote more, I turned it into, I guess, for myself, you know, just learning to love myself first, and knowing that, like, if I want to find a trait in someone else, whether that be a friend or a significant other, I should learn to possess that myself. Because if I don't know how to treat myself that way, how am I supposed to expect someone else to treat me that way? Do some self-love and some self-care, and not always, you know, going out with people and not always, like, hanging out with everyone and using all my time to be with other people, you know, using time to be with myself and learn more about myself.
Layla, I don't know if you watch RuPaul's Drag Race. I'm pretty sure you do, Isabel, but at the end, I'm guessing from the reaction you do, if you can't love yourself, how can you love somebody else? I'm sorry. Binge All Stars, guys, like, it's my life right now. It's really good. It's really addictive. Back to this. I definitely agree with all that you said. As an overachiever, I can definitely relate to that as well. I feel like the idea of, like, giving my all to someone, first of all, that's very, like, romanticized. It's very, like, appealing. It feels, like, very committed, devoted. It feels like that is such a pure, flawless relationship. But that is not true. As someone who's experienced this, it just leads to, like, a lot of emotional codependency. And it's just interesting, like, hearing her mom say that in the book, because it just makes me think of, like, the different relationships her mom has had in the book, like, with her, like, her husband, like, the mom's husband, like, who's Michelle Zahner's dad, and thinking about how, like, emotionally draining that relationship could have been, considering all the baggage that he holds, all the trauma that he holds as a drug addict, with all this, like, I'm pretty sure he had a pretty, like, rough family life too. Maybe I'm wrong, but I know that he had a, like, very long history of drug addiction, just a lot of, like, life struggles in general. And, like, Michelle Zahner talks about how, like, it was very unlikely that he wouldn't be the one to die first, whereas her mom got cancer. It made no sense where the guy who was literally wrecking his immune system consistently survived past her. And I think that, like, little quip, save 10% of yourself advice was referencing a lot of like her in that relationship, because that'd be a very painful relationship to like go all in and be very like 100% responsible for the other person. So in general, I just really love the quote. And there's also another quote that I also wanted to highlight. This is around the point where her mom is very, very sick. And she's in, I don't know if she was in Seoul at the time, but when she was watching her mom after going through chemo, she was losing a lot of her hair. She developed all these sores in her mouth and she in a lot of discomfort and she couldn't eat food. So she had to put a tube in her mom and like she could only eat food through that, which is very painful considering like food is such a big connection to her. She couldn't enjoy the comforts of like good tasting food because like the chili flakes that she would use would burn the sores and just aggravate the pain. So Michelle was talking about how like when she saw her mom being so deprived of the food that they both loved and she loved making for her, she started talking about how like she also lost all of her appetite. She lost any inclination to like cook these very intricate dishes. So she says that if I cannot be with my mother, I would be her. And I wanted to ask you what you think the significance of this is.
I think this is a really great quote. I was looking through my version of it on my phone and I actually highlighted this quote as well, because I was like, what is the context of this? And I was like, oh, I actually highlighted it. But I was reading the paragraph before it and I totally understand what Michelle's talking about, because she had to carry the things that her mom also had to carry, which I think is a very noble thing to do. Because when you think, oh, I have to take care of my ailing mother, it might seem like a daunting task. But I think that since she finds this connection through food with her mother, that she needs to be as close with her mom as possible. Because early in the book, she did talk about how important her mom was, how mom was like her first word, and how she always knew, even back then when she was a child, that her mom would be the most important person in her life. So her saying that if she could not be with her physically, whether it was in the hospital or after she passed, that she would carry on her legacy with her. And I think that's a very important part of Michelle's identity. And I think that ties back into like the last few pages of the book as well.
With the conclusion, I think you can definitely feel the sense that there's been like a long journey, like home and back home and like home again, and then feeling lost again, and then finally feeling like you've come to terms with this. And a lot of what I think about when I think about this mother-daughter relationship is like the growth and the changes, because I will think back to her being a teenager, seeing her white friend's mom, Nicole, who made, I forget if she was the daughter or the mother. I believe the mother was named Nicole. And she was this like pretty Western mother. From Michelle's perspective, she seemed like the perfect mother with these ambitions, with this personality that seemed to be more abundant than her mom's personality. And she like said how her thinking this was pretty anti-feminist, because Michelle's mom's main goal in life was to be a homemaker. And at the end, like, she basically is able to respect more the fact that she wants to be a homemaker and how that's her main central ambition in her life. And she had to respect that versus what she thought she could only respect, like, the more ambitious, like, 21st century kind of woman going out and, like, doing corporate jobs, when, like, in reality, both are very respectable things when you commit to it with, like, integrity and, like, passion. So I think later on, we could definitely see how, like, she becomes more closer to domestic ways of life in a way, whether it's through rediscovering like her love for kimchi and everything, which was really sentimental towards the end. And that was one of my like favorite chapters, her with the that one YouTuber that she had a very emotional attachment to. And then also with the idea of like not being with my mother, so I'm gonna be her, I'm gonna emulate and embody her. This is pretty dismal, but I was watching a podcast, I was listening to a podcast, and it was about, basically, this therapist was on this podcast and she was talking about how this one client of hers had a lot of abandonment issues, because when she was a kid, her mom would always forget to like pick her up from school. So she was always feeling neglected. There's a lot of neglect there, a lot of feelings of abandonment there. So later on in her life, when she sees her mom grieving over her dad who died, her mom went into this total different state of energy, a total different atmosphere was just around her mother. And it was very dead and it was very like lifeless. So basically the therapist says, like, because her mom was like, had a part of her that died inside, the client that she was talking about also took upon her that same form of death. That was her way of phrasing it. I butchered it a bit. There's more like psychological basis to it, but I think that's pretty relevant here. You can compare the two people, because I think Michelle sort of had the sense that she should like not go on with life, not enjoy like what she knows life can be when her mom is the one suffering, when her mom is like not alive to experience all this with her. So I think there's a lot of like that survivor's guilt, just guilt in general, that played into her wanting to like be this person who was suffering, be this person who's also carrying all these values that she never really exemplified when she was a younger teenager and more rebellious, as she put it, teenager in the book. So that's my thoughts in it. Isabel, did you have any thoughts on the quote?
Well, I also highlighted this quote at the end. Thinking about it now in relation to my mom and, you know, my mom's struggles, like immigrating to America, I think about it in the context of the things that my mom worked so hard for and the things that she has done in her life. But I think in the times where me and my mom will fight, or just like times where I feel separated from my mom, thinking about ways that I can, you know, embody things that she would do, like putting a smile on people's faces. She owns a business. So she tells me that, you know, one of the most, I guess, fulfilling things through her work is, you know, making people smile and making people's day, having that impact on other people shows that, you know, I'm carrying part of her with me, and I'm carrying a piece of her with me everywhere I go. And I think Michelle really does this through her cooking and when she spends time for herself, you know, kind of applying that like my version of the 10% rule, you know, taking self-care and time for herself. She does that through cooking and other things, but mainly through cooking. And you can see when she makes kimchi, that's one experience where she gets to be really mindful of where she is present. And I think that's, you know, her taking part of her mom with her after her death.
I'm wondering, what's your form of self-care? Like, when you imagine a self-care day, what does that entail?
I don't know about Layla, but my self-care day is definitely going on walks. I live in the city, so there's always like some hustle and bustle. And this might be a little biased of me, but I like listening to podcasts while I go on walks. I also like cooking a lot. I'm definitely not a baker, but I love cooking. I want to make a cookbook with my grandmother's recipes in it. So sometimes I'll make some of my grandmother's recipes. And I think self-care for me is really just sitting back and like watching TikTok or like listening to a podcast. I don't know about you. What's your self-care, Layla?
If I'm going to be honest, I don't really have a self-care routine. I just kind of notice when I'm like on the edge of something that's not going to be great. I either read, so that kind of explains why I'm a co-lead for the book club, but I play guitar, I like writing. For day, I'm a current events writer, but that can kind of get me not so happy sometimes, so I, before I was current events, I do write like prose and stuff, so I usually try to release my feelings through there. So my self-care is essentially any creative outlet I can. As being a STEM person, I need to get away from that and go into just writing, reading, playing music. It's very therapeutic. I'm not much of a walker though.
Yeah, being a humanities person, somehow I'm a combination of both you guys. I guess I gravitate towards there. Usually journaling is my go-to. Like, I'm actually very proud. This is the first time I've gone through like more than half of a journal, because I would usually abandon it because they're just negative. Thank you for the applause. Thank you, Isabel and Lila.
That's really admirable.
Yes, thank you. I am proud. And also with music, definitely relate to that. And literature in general, like I've become the person where like I will have like, I will just start like a bunch of random books and like, well, it'll be a long time before I finish them. Like Isabel, I told you about how I'm reading What It Means When a Man Falls from the Sky. I started it, I want to say maybe 3 months ago. It's not a long book. It's a short story compilation. And I'm still like less than 50% through. My Goodreads is suffering right now, but I'll get there. But reading and Spotify playlist is definitely like my way of like tapping the music as well for like therapy. Yeah, the nodding, yeah, for sure. So yeah, self-care is definitely really important. I think basically the point that we're trying to showcase is like, it's definitely different for everyone.
Now I'm wondering, what was one of the first books you read by an Asian writer?
That's hard. I'm like looking at my bookcase right now. Oh, it might have been Woman Warrior, honestly. Like, it might have been. No, I take that back. That might have been like the second one. I probably read Jenny Han, The Summer I Turned Pretty, or like a Jenny Han book, honestly. I'm like blanking. Yeah, it was probably something like that. And then I read Woman Warrior, and then I read Crying in H Mart. Like, my experience with Asian literature is very short right now. There was another memoir that I really loved. It's by Nicole Chung, All You Can Ever Know. It's about a Korean adoptee. And yeah, I like
really started, I really, yeah, really started that.
Crying. I started crying on within the first chapter because I related so hard to her. And I was like, wow, no one's ever written about this. So yeah, my Asian literature library needs to grow a little bit more. But yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons why I initially wanted to join the Dear Asian Youth Book Club, was because, one, I wanted to read more books and have kind of a schedule to read more books and, you know, have deadlines to read those, but also to diversify the authors I'm reading and the topics I'm reading about, because I know sometimes when I'm busy in the school year, I'm only reading the books I read in English, which are not diverse whatsoever. They're old white guys. But that's one of the reasons why I really like the Dear Asian Youth Book Club. I don't know about you, Naina. How many Asian authors have you read in your lifetime?
It's not an extensive list, like both of you guys. Probably the first one was Malala's autobiography, I'm Malala. And that was definitely a good read. I read that when I was in third, fourth grade. And when I was younger, I didn't even register that. I was like, oh, Asian literature. I mean, I'm pretty young, so I'm not like, oh, diversity, what great progress. No. But in my head, it didn't even resonate. It's like, oh, someone who's South Asian, this is like pretty good, you know, because like the way America teaches you about Indians and how like people, if you're in America, they will either assume you're Native American or you're not in Asia. You're just like in some random Indian continent. Anyways, that was one of the first Asian books, Asian authors I've read. And I think I've gone into Murakami, who, even though he's Asian, he has many flaws. I've gone into Kazuo Ishiguro, they're both Japanese authors, they're both very poetic, very good authors. And then I've also gone into, I really can't list any others, which is pretty concerning. But yeah, I definitely want to diversify my literature, which I definitely think is like what the book club is doing a really good job of. Right now you're reading The Sympathizer, which I definitely recommend for a lot of people. I think it's really good, and it's just very good for learning about history and geography, I'm just saying, you know. With Crying in H Mart, the only thing that was holding me back from starting Crying in H Mart, because I'd heard so much positive reviews, I'd heard so much positive feedback, and I didn't want to get like disappointed by it, was the potential of it being a very identity focused book. And what I mean by that is identity in the way of, like, I'm Asian American, like the typical identity book where like when it's a minority, where it's like I said, that tragedy feeling, like I'm an Asian American, I'm oppressed,
like tokenizing an experience,
tokenizing, yeah, I want, like, it's always the narrative of, like, I'm oppressed by my family, I want to run away from my oppressive, traditional, antiquated, in quotation marks, family, even though it's not antiquated, it's just Asian norms that are different from Western norms. And I'm just going to run away, be this Western girl, and just like, be the most American, but Asian American stereotype. And that's not healthy in any shape or form. Maybe that is a reality for people that have like negative experiences with their family, negative relationships with their family. But that cannot be the only form of representation for Asians. because then that's the only way we'll ever see them. Like, we don't see, like, teenage white girls only having bad relationships with their family. We see, like, a variety of experiences, which is what we should expect from Asian literature. So, yeah, that brings me to our last question, which is, Leila, what do you recommend for readers who want to diversify their literature, as all of us aim to do so as well?
I definitely suggest, like, just looking up Asian authors, Asian books. Like, if you don't know where to start, then just start there. It's the easiest way. And that's what I did. And now I have so many books by Asian authors that I've yet to get to. But it's like, you can't just, it's intimidating because you're like, wow, all these books that I've read are not by POC authors. And the easiest way just to do is just look it up, ask friends for recommendations, like research. I read No Longer Human by, what's his name? Osamu
Dazai, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's on my list. That's going to mentally and emotionally wreck me. What was your experience reading it?
It was crazy, honestly. I usually hate books when guys just complain about everything. But yeah. This complaining was
personal. It was poetic. It was substantial.
Poetic. But once you find an author who is Asian, perhaps, you can just look into books that maybe like them. You may like, you may not. And that's how books go. But I definitely think it's great that more Asian writers are telling their stories, because I randomly thought of this like halfway through that there was this book, Eleanor and Park. Do you guys know it? I was very uncomfortable reading it because it was a white woman describing the struggles of I think he's white and Asian, mixed, of a Korean American, and how he just feels sorry for himself all the time. And he's like, oh, I hate being Asian American, like, and there's no character growth whatsoever. So I think it's really great that if you want to dive into quote unquote real Asian literature, that it's a Google search away.
To, you know, open that door and like take that step to Google, you know, Asian authors, and it creates like a ripple effect for the people around you to diversify their literature as well. And for me personally, after reading Crying in H-Mart, I ended up talking to my English teacher about it. And luckily we read The Woman Warrior in English class this year. Which was actually a really interesting read. And because it is from the 1970s, it's not outdated, but, you know, it was written a while ago, and it's nice to read more contemporary literature. And I was talking about Crying in H-Mart, and now my teacher's read it, and he's considering putting it in the curriculum. So I think all that positive discourse and, you know, getting your friends to read it and other teachers to read it, and your parents even, that is so positive for the community around you to also diversify, one, their thoughts, their opinions, and their perspectives, along with, you know, reading's fun.
It's really good that your teacher is considering incorporating that into your curriculum, because the way the curriculum is in America, it's just Fahrenheit 451. It's, what's the other one with numbers? 1984. Like, and Catcher in the Rye. Are you kidding me? Like, is that the best we can do? And then the bane of my existence, like in eighth grade, we were going to read To Kill a Mockingbird, which that's the one. Yeah. And my English teacher, I respect him so much compared to all my other English teachers that I have had outside of eighth grade. He prevails all of them. He's just at the top of the list and he knows it. I like literally, at my current school that I'm at, we were told to like write an essay about like education, the importance of education. I wrote it about him and I emailed him the essay and he's like, wow, like, thank you so much. Like, I'm telling you, I respect him. And he let us read Homegoing by Yao Jiaxi instead, which Yao Jiaxi is an amazing author. I really recommend her. I love her. And I also like her other book, Transcendent Kingdom. It's also good. I recommend to everyone. And it's a much better way to like have African representation, African-American representation, where it's really good to like swap out specific books like that, where there's clearly someone more capable of writing from their own experiences, you know? unless you're Mindy Kaling. Like, not that she's written any literature, I believe, but that's another thing. The reason to diversify and make sure you read a lot of Asian literature or Asian media or Asian content is so that you're not only getting the perspective of one person as well. Because if you're only learning about the South Asian community from Mindy Kaling, I'm concerned for you and for myself. So the point is diversify.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's just really great that your teacher is considering it, because that does not happen a lot. Like this year in AP Lang, like some of the books were like, I know like he had to teach them and my teacher was not happy about it because it's like required reading. But we did read Their Eyes Were Watching God, Zora Neale Hurston. That was such a good read. I'm like, this is what will happen if we just swap out the things they carried, albeit it's a good book, but the things they carried with the sympathizer, you know, like we could find such better nuance if you need to talk about the Vietnam War, then find a Vietnamese person who wrote it.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, creating conversation around books and, you know, getting more people to read books like Crying in H Mart, which is, I mean, we've been talking about, you know, the themes in it, but also it's just good writing, you know, it's good literature. And having other people read it, like my white friends read it, they've talked to me about how they've related to Michelle Zahner's experiences of grief, which is crazy to me to think about, because at the end of the day, you know, grief is grief, but for some reason people want to focus on the fact that it's an Asian person writing about grief.
Yeah, my first reaction to hearing you say like you introduced it to your white friends, my first reaction was a bit of like almost like hesitance, because the idea of like being exposed in that way, because of the lack of Asian representation in our curriculums, that exposure feels almost like unnatural, which is a very bad reaction for me to like go to, for me to just like gravitate towards. So that just showcases the importance of diversifying curriculums. And I, like you said, like grief is like, it's obviously like there are a lot of different experiences that can be influenced by like the cultural norms you're surrounded by, or like the way your relationship was impacted by cultural norms. But at the end of the day, it's something we all experience in a way. Every person is going to experience loss in their lives, and it's not something that like really is something that we can divide by culture or divide by race, ethnicity, nationality, etc. So I definitely agree with that.
Michelle Zahner did say that at its core, Crying in H Mart is about grief, but it's also about a mother and daughter relationship. And whether you're Korean American, Chinese American, Asian American, or non-POC, you have that relationship with your mother. You have that complicated, like you fight, but you love her. And whether you have issues, it's like, yeah, she's your mom. Like, I know that there's a lot more nuance to it for some people, but like people just tend to focus on it. It's like, oh, it's just like an Asian tiger mom. It's like, no, it's a mom. It's not a mom. You don't need to label with anything. It's a mom and her daughter. And I think that's what draws people in, because that's what it is.
Thank you so much, Leila, for everything you talked about with us today. We just like to end, since we're encouraging everyone to go to their libraries, which is very easy if you live in Boston, by the way. I recently discovered how beautiful the Boston Public Library is. Total side note, but I can't get over it. Isabel, you are one lucky person, I'm telling you. Singapore needs to like upgrade. But back to the original point. Leila, can you tell us how, or tell our listeners how to join the Day Book Club?
Yeah, it's totally easy. We have a Discord. We have, there's a site called Book Clubs where we run all of the meetings. We post meeting links. But the way you can get to this is through a link in the Dear Asian Youth card that's linked in the Instagram bio. And it's just a join the Dear Asian Youth Book Club. And you just, it's just to sign up, you write your name, your age, any questions. It's pretty simple. And we're launching an Instagram very soon, so you can also keep up with us there. So it's very easy just to join. You don't have to come to every meeting. You can just read, text us on Discord, be like, oh wow, this is like super crazy. and it's fairly easy, and we really want everyone to join, so definitely join.
Great, thank you so much.
Want more of Dear Asian Girl? You can find us everywhere on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Anchor. We're on everything. Can't get enough? Subscribe, follow, rate, review to get all the updates on the latest at DAG. Let us know your feedback and what we can do to improve. We also can be found on Instagram. Follow us at Dear Asian Girl to receive updates about our latest episodes and fun facts about the host. We'd love for you to reach out. DAG, Dear Asian Girl, a podcast dedicated to share the stories of Asian girls everywhere. For the Asian girl, by the Asian girl.